NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, when school's back, the phones will be off. When classes resume after Labor Day, Eldred Central and Sullivan West are enforcing strict all-day cell phone bans under New York's new rules. River Reporter's Leah Mayo tells us what it means for students, teachers, and parents. From would-be ski slopes to forever wild watershed in Neversink, a decades-old alcohol ban changed the course of a mountain's history. Now, 3,100 acres of Blue Hill property are permanently protected, safeguarding clean water, wildlife, and climate resilience. In the latest episode of Cats Cast, Brett Berry talks with the Open Space Institute. Plus, it's Woodstock Anniversary Week, and we're talking to Dr. Neil Hitch from the Museum at Bethel Woods about how they're celebrating the anniversary. First, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Kristen Wright. Stocks opened higher this morning as a new report showed inflation remained elevated last month. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped about 210 points in early trading.
Consumer prices in July were up 2.7% from a year ago, roughly in line with what forecasters had expected. Falling gasoline prices helped to keep the overall cost of living from rising more. So-called core inflation, which strips out volatile energy and food prices, rose to 3.1%. The effects of President Trump's worldwide tariffs are visible in the rising price of imported goods, such as furniture and toys. Additional tariffs ordered this month could push prices higher still. Nevertheless, investors are betting the Federal Reserve will see an opening to cut interest rates by a quarter percentage point when policymakers meet next month. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump says his move to seize control of Washington, D.C.'s police force should be seen as a warning by other cities. Trump is deploying hundreds of National Guard troops in the nation's capital, as NPR's Brian Mann reports.
During a press conference from the White House, Trump pointed to cities led by Democrats, including Chicago, Detroit, and New York City, and said he hoped the federal crackdown on crime underway in Washington would spur them to action.
Other cities are hopefully watching this. They're all watching, just like everyone's watching here. They're all watching, and maybe they'll self clean up.
In fact, crime in Washington, D.C. has been going down, according to local and federal statistics. Many cities around the U.S. have seen violence and property crimes drop sharply in recent years. Brian Mann, NPR News, Washington.
As Trump announced the deploying of the National Guard in D.C. yesterday, a separate trial started in California over the administration's use of the Guard in Los Angeles earlier this year. California is seeking to end the troop activation. The trial is due to last until tomorrow with a decision expected from the judge. President Trump says he wants to see what Russian President Vladimir Putin has in mind as far as ending its war with Ukraine. The two leaders are meeting for a summit in Alaska on Friday. Today, European Union leaders are warning that the path to peace can't be decided without Ukraine. Officials are investigating what triggered a deadly explosion at a U.S. steel plant near Pittsburgh. Two people died in yesterday morning's blast, and at least 10 others were hurt. Clairton Coke Works converts coal to coke, a key component in the steelmaking process. The Clean Air Council is concerned about air quality since the explosion. Tom Pike is with the group.
The concern is for folks who have asthma or some kind of pre-existing condition, and also for children. So children's lungs are smaller than an adult's lungs. It doesn't take as much particulate matter or pollution to cause problems.
The Allegheny County Health Department lifted its stay indoors advisory for people living near the plant. This is NPR News in Washington. Health officials in Wyoming are tracking down visitors from 38 states and 7 countries after hundreds of people were potentially exposed to rabies at a hotel in Grand Teton National Park. Jenna McMurtry reports.
At least 200 people who stayed at Jackson Lake Lodge may have been exposed to rabies from a suspected bat colony at the hotel. The hotel has closed 8 rooms after 8 reported run-ins with bats since June. If left untreated, rabies is almost always fatal. State Health Officer Alexia Harris.
What we're really concerned about, certainly people who have had actual physical contact with bats, because the way that rabies is spread is through the bat's saliva.
The hotel is scheduled to host the Jackson Hole Economic Policy Symposium next week. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell is expected to speak. For NPR News, I'm Jenna McMurtry in Jackson, Wyoming.
Authorities in Greece say they found nearly 600 pounds of cocaine in a shipment of bananas from Ecuador after a tip. Police opened the container that was already loaded from a ship onto a truck, and the packets came tumbling out. And this is not the first such case. Summer's dazzling Perseids meteor shower peaks tonight into tomorrow morning. It may not be as visible as in recent years, though, because the moon will be really bright, and that makes it harder to see the bright fireballs and long streaks of light and color that follow the meteors. The Perseids are best viewed in the northern hemisphere during pre-dawn hours. Viewing does last until August 23rd, so there's more time. I'm Kristen Wright, and this is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include EBSCO, supporting open source technology and making open platforms possible for libraries of all sizes. Learn more at EBSCO.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station. Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. School's back in session soon, but for students, their phones will be staying put. New York's new statewide cell phone restrictions will be going into effect with the new school year, banning smartphones, smartwatches, and earbuds during the school day, except for specific needs. The goal is to cut down on distractions and boost focus, but the change is sparking conversation in classrooms at home and in the community. Joining us now is the River Reporter's news editor, Liam Mayo, to talk about how those new rules are going to be playing out locally at Eldred Central and Sullivan West and what impact they might have. Liam, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for having me.
So what are the specific procedures that Eldred Central, Sullivan West, and others are putting in place to enforce this bell-to-bell ban on internet-enabled devices?
Yeah, there are a couple of specific things that each of them are doing. For Eldred, just looking at the policy, there are a couple of different ways it comes in. At the elementary school level, students are discouraged from bringing devices to school. Any device brought to school must be silenced and kept in the school office. The middle school level, they must be silenced and scored in homeroom device caddies. And at the high school level, student devices must be silenced and stored in designated centralized device holders. And then for Sullivan West, our central school district, grades pre-K through 4, internet-enabled devices are not allowed at school. Grades 5 to 6, students will turn their phones into their homeroom teachers. And then secondary school students are responsible for keeping their phones in their school-issued lockers.
And I mentioned that there are some exceptions being made for medical, educational, or safety needs. How are they going to manage those exceptions for folks?
Yeah, I mean, I think it, as far as we're hearing, it's just like conversations that occur between parents and school administration on a case-by-case basis with IEPs, individualized education programs, and other such conversations.
Now, you guys put out a local call to schools to see how they're handling this transition. What did you hear from the Eldred Central School District Superintendent about this adjustment and if it's going to be an easy adjustment or not?
Yeah, we heard from both schools with it sort of within our coverage area, Eldred and Sullivan West, or both of the schools that are kind of closest to us, that this will be a bit of a cultural shift. Tracy Ferrara, Eldred Central School District Superintendent, said that, quote, this will be a cultural shift for students, staff, and families at the junior, senior high school. For Sullivan West, Superintendent Kathleen Bressler said that there were already areas where could not use devices, but that expanding it to the full day will be different because phones were kind of part of the way students went about their days, both communicating with their parents or working with their teachers in set educational limits, or just students using like their phone's calendar to keep up with schoolwork. So both school districts said that they had really tried to work with the community in advance of these changes coming into effect, both to sort of listen to what the concerns were and to sort of let people know that this was happening.
And they had a series of meetings at Eldred. They mentioned that they had about five meetings, I think, in the summer. And did you hear what some of the community response was? And did they also talk to students?
We didn't hear sort of specifics on what came out of those meetings, although I think both both districts held meetings in advance of the formulation of their specific plans. I think we did hear that both student or both schools reached out to students to sort of hear what they were thinking.
Governor Kathy Hochul has said, quote, "We want freedom for kids and parents," is how she's characterizing this new rule. And they're also putting some state funds behind that. What are those funds being used for? And have you heard from those school districts about how they're already utilizing those funds?
Yeah, there's about $13.5 million in state funds available to help schools purchase device storage and set up enforcement plans. You know, if you break those out across all the schools in the state, that's not very much. We did hear that at Sullivan West, they got $5,210 to support the policy, which will be used to purchase storage solutions for main offices and classrooms where students may need assistance. But I wanted to highlight one thing about sort of Hochul's approach to Hochul's reasoning behind the ban, which is safety. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that gets brought up is parents want to be able to contact their students in an emergency situation, and they're concerned that like a cell phone ban would keep them from doing that. But as she was sort of presenting this proposal, Hochul said that it's actually safer for students not to have their cell phones in an emergency, because the last thing you want your child to be doing in an emergency situation is pulling out their cell phone rather than focusing on their teacher or focusing on the security officer at the front of the room who is trained to take care of them and keep them safe. So I just thought that was an interesting like part of the conversation around why or why not to have this kind of ban in place.
Yeah, and Sullivan West already had some cell phone policies in place prior to this mandate from the governor. So it might be an easier transition for them there.
Yeah. Bressler mentioned that sort of there were already areas where students could or could not use devices, and that could definitely make it easier for students because, as you said, because students have already kind of gotten used to a certain level of restrictions on cell phone usage. But I think another thing that comes out of it is the fact that there is a statewide mandate now means that whatever steps schools had already taken to sort of listen to their communities and figure out what was the right level for their students individually on a very local level of cell phone usage, that kind of gets overruled by this now stricter statewide mandate. It sounded like from Sullivan West that they'd already sort of figured out a level of phone access where it could be like beneficial for parents, teachers, students, where it could be an asset to the classroom experience. And now there's this new statewide mandate that says, no, well, actually, like what we're finding is that there is no good level of like classroom experience, or that like there needs to be these stricter rules in place.
You also had an interesting perspective from the president of the New York State United Teachers Association, who said she's already seeing the difference in schools that are adopting this policy early, that students are passing notes instead of being on phones.
Yeah. I mean, I think.
Didn't you get in trouble for that in school, passing notes?
Well, I mean, I think that sort of highlights one of the things about this whole cell phone conversation, which is, there are some things that are uniquely harmful about cell phones for the student experience. One of the things that Hochul brought up was social media and how sort of being on social media for extended periods of time, especially for children, has proven to lead to worse mental health outcomes. But like you mentioned, like passing notes was always a thing. Like students, like whispering behind the teacher's back was always a thing. So there's a certain part of the cell phone conversation that is like specific to cell phones. And there is a certain part of the cell phone conversation that is just like broader school discipline conversations that, you know, happened, I imagine, in the cave times when students were passing rocks with little like scribbles of charcoal on them to each other.
Hey, what do you know about my school experience? So, you know, school for most kids starting after Labor Day. Do you guys plan to follow up with students to see how they're kind of dealing with this new reality when it comes to the cell phone ban?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And we'd encourage any students or parents who are feeling a certain kind of way about this to reach out to us and sort of start that conversation.
It's Liam Mayo. He's the news editor of the River Reporter. That reporting about the statewide new cell phone ban in New York State for schools is in the current issue. It's at riverreporter.com or on newsstands. Also, a lot of other good stuff in there. Great reporting from Liam Mayo and the team. Thank you, Liam.
Thank you. Have a great day.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, celebrating Woodstock. It's the 56th anniversary, and we'll find out more about all the events that are planned after this. It's Radio Chatskill.
With federal funding for public media eliminated, listeners all over this country are stepping up to support public radio. Hi, I'm Elsa Chang from All Things Considered.
And I'm Aisha Roscoe from Weekend Edition. We're here to share a little of what people are saying. Kyle in Brooklyn says, I'm skipping two lattes a month to keep Steve Inskeep in my ear each morning. We see you and thank you, Kyle.
Farouk in El Paso, Texas says, public radio is one of the key bloodlines of this country, keeping communities connected. Thank you, Farouk.
And Diane in Juneau, Alaska says, I'm so sorry this day has come. You have my support as long as I am able. Thanks, Diane.
If you have already made your gift to the station, or if you're a sustaining donor, seriously, thank you.
If not, please join the movement to protect public radio today and tell us why you're stepping up.
Here's how to donate, and thanks.
Give now at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. It's Woodstock Anniversary Week, and here to tell us about everything that's going on as they celebrate the anniversary of the 1969 Woodstock Music and Art Fair is Dr. Neil Hitch from the Museum at Bethel Woods and our own personal Woodstock correspondent who's celebrating all things peace, love, and NPR, Mr. Jason Dole. Good morning.
Good morning.
Dr. Neil, this is not necessarily what you would say 56 is like a big anniversary, you know, a milestone anniversary, but there's a lot of stuff going on this week. You guys want to jump in and tell us where we should start? I think we had a preview yesterday, Jason, right?
Yeah, yeah, we kicked off our anniversary week by talking to photographer Elliot Landy, both Chatskill and Local Edition, and he's a key feature of what's going on at Bethel Woods this afternoon as they kick off what they're doing, right?
Yeah, Elliot Landy is the special guest this week for the 56th anniversary. Iconic Woodstock photographer. He took a series of pictures of people hanging on the scaffolding, which are just classic images. In fact, they're all over the museum. And when I say all over the museum, in August, we've actually mounted an Elliot Landy makeover of the main exhibit. What does that mean? Well, that mean we printed off a bunch of Elliot Landy images and we covered everyone else's images with them. So in the main exhibit, it's only Elliot Landy images of the Woodstock Festival.
Oh, wow. That's breaking news for me. I didn't know you even went that far. That's great. So I definitely got to get back into the main exhibit and see what that looks like for a limited time, I guess, right?
Yeah.
For this season.
Not
yes,
permanently.
It's just this month. And then at 4 o'clock today, Elliot will be in the main exhibit talking about these photographs. So Elliot Landy coming is in the spread of Tuesday, Wednesday. Today is like an informal fun day. Tomorrow's more of a formal traditional day. But today Elliot is going to do a sharing stillness energy work in the main exhibit. This is something that he is a practitioner of, you know, meditative lifestyle and at 4 o'clock, he's going to be an informal talk about taking pictures at Woodstock. This is going to be centered around the scaffolding that is in the center of the museum exhibit and the main exhibit. At 5 o'clock, we have our anniversary welcome, and it is we are featuring the unveiling of Ted Galloway's donation of the iconic No Hippies tabletop sign. I don't know if you know what this is. This is a piece that is like it was a white sign hand painted in red, and it was no hippies, no 150,000 hippies here, boycott Yasgur milk. In the Yasgur story, this is the piece where Miriam Yasgur says, if you think you're going to scare Max off, you don't know Max. Like, that sign is only going to make him more committed.
Max's farm, where the festival was held.
Right. The farmer on whose property, you know, hosted the Woodstock Music and Arts Fair. But is this sign one that was, like, featured in news coverage at the time? Is this the one that when you look at back at old articles, like in the Times Herald Record, and see, you know, the neighbors are getting ornery? Is that this item?
That is this sign.
Okay. Neighbors put it up on the side of the road to try to stop this, and, that, you know,
that's exactly right. Like, it is an iconic piece of Woodstock history. It is an iconic piece of Sullivan County history.
And we celebrate this festival now, but at the time, there was some opposition.
Yeah, I mean, at the time.
And which is why it came here anyway. It was opposed to in Woodstock and ended up here in Bethel.
At the time, and for the subsequent 20 to 30 years, too, you know, there was a lot of resistance to it, yes.
Yes, it's interesting that you think about the Woodstock Monument being put up by the Gelish family, the then current owners of the Yasgur farm property, not until 1984.
Yeah.
And again, as I understand that, it took them a couple of years just to like to get it through everything else. That even in 1984, there was a great deal of resistance to celebration of Woodstock.
And so then today you've got a lot of focus with Elliot, a special dinner tonight as well, some campground activities as well, and non-campers even welcome. Tell us about the Ember Sessions part one. What's that? It sounds like fire. I believe fire by itself.
So we have implemented camping and glamping at Bethelwood Center for the Arts, and we do have areas where, like, if you're glamping after a show, there's like a fire pit. Tonight we're doing almost like a concert. Now, I don't say it's a concert because it's campfire, right? Like in it, but we are having some signature artists come play, and that is open. So it will be after kind of everything ends and wraps up. There will be this kind of I don't want to call it an after party, but an afterglow, let's say.
All right, there you go. I like that. And then tomorrow, Peace in Progress is the theme. Talk about the Peace in Progress theme and how it's sort of, I guess that's on Thursday. I've skipped ahead. There's so much. Tomorrow is Wednesday, the 13th, Dialogue to Dance. Talk a little bit more about what's going on for Wednesday's schedule.
So in the Wednesday schedule, again, at the museum, we will be doing at 1 o'clock, Elliot Landy, Spirit of a Generation. That is a fairly traditional slideshow and lecture of kind of his body of work. At 2:30 will be a film screening of The Last Seat in the House, which is the story of Bill Hanley, who is the father of festival sound. And then tomorrow evening will be Horizon Happy Hour with Juma Sultan. Juma Sultan was on stage with Jimi Hendrix as a percussionist, has kind of a really forward-thinking kind of jazz-inspired band, and that should be great. And then Elliot Landy will also be opening with this manipulation of light and photography and sound that he does called Landy Vision. Elliot is not stuck in the 60s. His work has really progressed through the last five decades. He is an artist, and so he is now embracing technology as a way of kind of moving his art into the future. And so this should be pretty cool.
And in some ways, you know, technology is allowing him to do what he wanted to do with his art decades ago. He was a little bit ahead of the curve with some of his ideas about merging visuals and music. But when I spoke to him, what impressed me was this through line of, like, you know, he's known for his rock photography, even though he did that for a very brief period. And when he tells the story of how he got started in doing that, it's about stumbling upon a Country Joe and the Fish show and light show. And that was a key part of his experience and introduction to loud electric music, was that pairing of the audio and the visual. And now here he is, you know, more than a half century later, still, you know, pursuing that aesthetic.
Yeah. And I would say, very specifically, we've also mounted an exhibit in the basement of the museum, an area we call the Crossroads Gallery, which is a retrospective of his work. It is his life's work and the different periods that he has gone through as an artist. That's really the opening of that exhibit is the dinner tonight at 6:30, which is a ticketed dinner with a very limited number of seats. But that's because it's in the special exhibit and focused on this exhibit downstairs.
And talk a little bit about the songwriting workshop that you have as well. I like how you guys are not only incorporating the history of what's happened, but then just the aspect of what this was all about and how you're advancing that. What can folks expect of this songwriting workshop?
So anniversary week this year is in partnership or sits alongside of a new initiative, Consider Peace. This week, the Consider Peace Summit is a partnership with Braver Angels and the Bethel Woods Center for the Arts. And we will be doing several kind of peace-related like summit or conversations, or in this case, a songwriting shop. And Braver Angels has a program where they go around the country and they kind of put people in a room and talk about current issues and then try and express dialogue through written music. And so we'll be doing that at the museum on Friday. There will be a share out of the music that's written. So at 11 o'clock on Friday in the event gallery, kind of you could come here. That's an open public program, and you could come here. Music that was written this week inspired by conversations centered around peace.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Dr. Neil Hitch of the Museum at Bethel Woods about the Woodstock Anniversary Week. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk more about peace, peace in progress, the peace theme at this year's anniversary celebration. You're listening to Radio Chatskill, peace, love, and NPR.
Next time on the Retro Cocktail Hour, we'll hear from Big Kahuna and the Copa Cat Pack. There's music for the original swinger and something new by the Enchanted Tiki Cats. Daryl Brogdon here. Join me where the music's always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Wednesday night at 7 here on Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Calicoon Theater, an updated vintage movie theater with new releases, film festivals, nostalgic screenings, live music events, and more. Information and schedule at thecalicoontheater.com.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Bethel Woods Center for the Arts and the Museum at Bethel Woods are celebrating the anniversary of the 1969 Woodstock Music and Art Fair. They annually do that in mid-August. It's mid-August, so we're doing it, and we're talking about that with Dr. Neil Hitch from the Museum at Bethel Woods and our own Jason Dole.
You know, I just want to point out for everybody, and I don't know what significance this has, and Neil, you can weigh in on this if it means anything to you, but this weekend is going to be only the sixth time since the original Woodstock Festival that the dates of the anniversary fall on the exact days it happened. In 1969, Friday, the first ticketed day of the festival, was the 15th. This week will be the 15th. Does that hold any significance whatsoever for you, Neil?
Well, I mean, it holds significance, I would say. But also, there's a reality. Bethel Woods Center for the Arts is a pavilion with a show schedule. So, and often those shows hit the weekend. So it's hard to develop like programs, let's say, on a weekend that would be, it's hard to say smaller programs, but, you know, 10,000 people are going to come see a show. And we're not going to have 10,000 people at an Elliot Landy lecture. At the same time, those Elliot Landy lectures are precious, and there is, you know, a desire to kind of have some real engagement with the people that are still around who experienced Woodstock firsthand. And what we try to create during anniversary week is those opportunities. So, like, again, when we say it's, well, it's Tuesday, Woodstock wasn't on Tuesday, August 12th, but that gives us a window to really share out and talk about what Woodstock was, what happened, do some really innovative programming moving into the weekend. Though on Friday, like, that is the anniversary day, and there are cool stuff happening on Friday.
Before we get to Friday, let's talk about Thursday's Peace in Progress theme. You have a Bethel Woods Peace Fellow. Who is that, and what is the keynote that this Peace Fellow is going to be addressing?
Yeah, so Mark Metzger works with Braver Angels in the city. He's comes from a music background, comes from a theater, musical theater background. But he spent 18 years with Camp Winter Rainbow and Wavy Gravy in California, moving from like somebody attending the camp, which is kind of a circus style camp, and then eventually being a counselor there. So he's a kind of a new generation working in the area of peace, peace initiatives, with a background with Woodstock. Like, he knows intimately what the hog farm did at Woodstock, kind of the vibe that that the hog farm brings to events, and is kind of the perfect new generation of someone that fundamentally understands Woodstock and 3 days of peace and music, but didn't experience it, but experienced the results of what happened post Woodstock, which is people devoting their lives to peace.
Do you think there's more relevance to that topic and idea now in the moment that we seem to be living in?
Well, I mean, I can't believe that anyone wouldn't think that there's more relevance to the concept of peace. I will also say peace has been something that we have been, humans, right? Humanity has been after for probably forever.
Yeah.
And certainly we're in a period today that's not that different than the period of 1960, which is a polarized country. And, but certainly in the same vein, it's people seeking a break, seeking to come somewhere and have a weekend where they can focus on peace. They can focus on like a shared experience of just being together, a gathering. And I think like what the Peace Summit and some of these peace initiatives are, they are putting some people in a room to talk about how we, not necessarily how we achieve peace, but how do we create environments where peace can happen, or how can we create weekends that we can, like Woodstock, we can just take a minute to say, you know, let's just chill for a minute, have a campfire, let's listen to some music, let's write some songs, and let's not, like, let's let the stress of all the outside influences, all the stuff that we in our mind think is bad, maybe, let's let that go, and let's just share, care for one another. Like, that is Woodstock, and I think that's also what this Peace Summit is trying to figure out, or put people in a room and say, how can we push this forward?
And doing it with somebody that essentially comes from the school of, you know, Hugh Romney, or school of the hog farm, which did so much to propagate a sense of peace at the original Woodstock Festival.
Yeah, I mean, it's full circle, right? Like, yeah, literally what we are trying to teach as a history is this hog farm and the place where peace happened. And now what we're doing is working with this new generation of trying to find people that will bring that forward for the next 50 years.
And just real quick, let's just mention what's going on Friday, because I do want to talk about what we'll be covering here tomorrow on air. What's this film screening, Woodstock 3 Days That Defined a Generation? Is this a documentary?
Yeah, at 9 a.m. we are screening the 2019 KPBS documentary.
Okay, public TV ones.
Yeah, which is a great one.
PBS for the 50th.
At 2 o'clock, this isn't written anywhere, but I'm telling you, it's breaking news. At 2 o'clock, Max and Ira Stone are going to be doing a mini concert in the special exhibit. They were on stage with Burt Summer, coming from Connecticut, nice, to do this, wow, mini concert. At 3:30, Ken Bray, what we're calling the 1969 Silversmith. He was a vendor at Woodstock. He'll be doing a presentation. And then all day long, we're doing main gate tours on Friday. Like, it's a main gate tour special. We're going to run carts all day long. We're really trying to get people on the grounds, on the site, experience this new tour. experience a guided tour.
Yeah,
Jason, you did that.
And I did. I was lucky to be invited along and literally embedded on a main gate tour of a returning alumnus. And her name is Minna, and it was her first time back to the site in 56 years. And we're going to hear her story tomorrow. In fact, you, listener, will be able to go along on this main gate tour. So that's why I wanted to take a moment just to have you describe what happens at this main gate tour in this area of Woodstock that people might not be familiar with that you're covering there.
Well, since 2020, we've been working on this research and investigation of what we call the Bendy Woods, which is the area vendors were, and it was the area of trails that sat between the hog farm and the main concert field, festival field. Again, hog farm is where, I mean, it's where the free stage was, where the free kitchen was. It was one of the main camping areas, and the hog farm set up there to be kind of a model of how, you know, they're a commune, but it's a model of how you live in the woods, right? How you feed a bunch of people that aren't family, but are living together. And so this tour takes you on a golf cart. It looks at these areas. We show pictures. We take you to a spot where a picture was taken and we show you the picture. So we kind of look at what was planned, what happened, and then talk about the structure of the main gate. There was a main gate at Woodstock and we show you where that was, and we talk about how you would have given a ticket and gone to the festival had, you know, only 50 to 100,000 people showed up.
I love how, you know, when you think of journalists being embedded, usually you think of them like at, you know, political campaigns or with the military. You, Jason, embedded at Bethel Woods.
Yes.
That's what we bring you here.
Yeah.
He was embedded in peace.
He's embedded in peace. See?
You know, and local history.
Yeah.
You know, because it's such a big part of, like, who we are here. And I, you know, I often wonder, like, why, you know, we spent, you know, imagine throwing a party that's so big that they build a museum for it, you know? But I mean, part of it is then this museum and all of these little details that you're trying to track down become a gateway into saying something about this time in American history, not just local history here.
Yeah. I mean, something happened at Woodstock clearly that was remarkable,
right?
It, like, we, this film screening, it's 3 days that defined a generation. We've done probably 1,500 oral histories around the country. Many people will talk about their experience at Woodstock had defined the rest of their life. For that, when we talk about peace or we talk about legacy, for almost all the people that I talk to and interview, we will say, what is the legacy for you of Woodstock? And they will say something in terms of, you know, I spent this 3 days where people came together and made the choice for peace. They shared everything they had. They cared for one another. And I have lived the rest of my life knowing that peace is possible. And for me, I think that's an important story. And that's a story that's worth having a museum for. Mm-hmm. And that's a story that's worth doing these kind of programs and getting people to the site where this happened and really sharing that peace is possible.
All the info that we've been talking about is up now at BethelWoodsCenter.org, and please be listening tomorrow on Chatskill, because Neil and myself will be back, but we will be bringing you on this golf cart tour that not everybody gets to see. You will be able to see it on the radio tomorrow, so definitely be listening for that.
Jason Dole and Dr. Neil Hitch of the Museum at Bethel Woods. We're in partnership with them this week to celebrate the anniversary of the 1969 Woodstock Music and Art Fair. Thank you both, and we look forward to tomorrow.
Thank you.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, in the latest episode of Cat's Cast, Brett Berry talks with the Open Space Institute about how thousands of acres of land in Neversink went from speculation to stewardship and what its future means for the Catskills. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Stephen Dubner on the next Freakonomics Radio. For decades, the great fear was overpopulation, and now it's the opposite.
If an economy is shrinking in population, it will also shrink in economic output.
But when it comes to baby making, there is a surprising amount we still don't understand.
It feels unjust that we know so little about how our reproductive system works.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. This afternoon at 1 o'clock on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. In the Catskills town of Neversink, the dream of ski slopes faded decades ago when alcohol bans kept developers at bay. That twist of fate laid the groundwork for something even far more lasting. Today, the Blue Hill Properties forested watershed is now protected through a deal by the Open Space Institute. OSI's landmark acquisition of 3,100 acres strengthens watershed integrity, advances New York's 30 by 30 climate goals, and secures the ecological legacy of this region. In the latest episode of Cats Cast, the Catskills podcast, host and producer Brett Berry is talking to OSI's Charlie Burgess, the OSI's Northern New York Stewardship Manager, and Tom Gravel, OSI's Northeast Project Manager, about how they went from a decades-long journey from speculation to stewardship and what it means for clean water, climate resilience, and the future of public access.
It's hard to imagine this place with 40, 50, 200 homes scattered all over it, standing by this pristine trout stream with soft rain falling and everything green and lush. It would have drastically changed this place.
That's Charlie Burgess, a stewardship manager for the Open Space Institute, which earlier this year invested $6.2 million to protect 3,100 acres of contiguous forest land in the southwest Catskills. The Blue Hill property was privately held for decades and recently slated for residential and commercial development. OSI intends to transfer the land to New York State as an addition to the adjacent Willowemoc Wild Forest. In doing so, this would be the largest addition to the Catskill Forest Preserve in nearly 25 years.
My name is Charlie Burgess. I'm the stewardship manager for the Open Space Institute. I manage land from the Catskills to the Adirondacks.
I am Tom Gravel. I'm a senior project manager, and I work on land conservation projects in the Hudson Valley, in the Catskills, and actually also a little bit in the New Jersey Highlands. Yeah, so it's always nice when I can get out of the office and get out to properties like these and stretch my legs.
And if you can tell me, what is OSI?
Open Space Institute is a land conservation organization that protects land up and down the East Coast. And we protect land to provide new opportunities for public recreation. We protect land that safeguards water quality and clean air. We protect land that provides natural defenses against extreme weather and climate change, protect land that mitigates against flooding, and protecting forests that capture carbon. And then another benefit of the land that we protect is that it provides critical habitat for plants and animals. And although our reach has kind of expanded since we were founded in 1974, we still work a lot in New York, in particular the Hudson Highlands, the Shawangunks Capital Region, Adirondacks, and then right here in the Catskills.
So this is, we've just walked in a little bit, but this is a beautiful piece of property. How did you, well, I guess, where are we? Tell us a little bit about this parcel.
Sure. So we are in the town of Neversink in Sullivan County. We're basically in the southwest corner of the Catskill Park. And before OSI acquired this property, it was pretty much one of the last remaining privately owned, like large pieces of property left in the Catskill Park. And we tried over the years to see if we could interest the past owner in a conservation sale, and they always politely declined. And then in the spring of 2021, there were plans that were unveiled for a pretty large-scale development. It was essentially to build a resort that had two hotels. It was also going to be single-family and multifamily uses, along with retail and commercial. And the owner/developer needed a zoning change in order for that to go through. And after numerous town board meetings, presentations by the developer, and lots of public comment, the town board ultimately decided to not amend their town master plan. That still meant that the previous owner could develop it as of right in terms of residential structures, but ultimately they decided they would rather just entertain a sale. And so we were able to fortunately negotiate an agreement. And back in the late winter, early spring of 2024, we went under agreement for in order to purchase the property.
This is 3,100 acres. Single owner before you purchased it?
It was. So it's my understanding that a gentleman by the name of Moshe Meyer, who was a Romanian-Israeli architect and developer, basically pieced the property together in order to get to that 3,100-acre number in the 1960s. And it sounded like his idea was to build a ski resort here. And they went as far as, creating a number of ski trails that we just drove by. But ultimately, I heard that the development didn't go through because at the time, Neversink was a dry town. And I guess the thought was that without beer, a ski resort wouldn't be successful, maybe.
A 1970 edition of the New York Times confirms that 35 years after Neversink voters outlawed the sale of alcohol, several wet options were up for another referendum vote. Moshe Meyer's Marcent Development Company prepared a letter to the town stating, "It is an established fact the world over that such a development cannot reach its potential unless alcoholic beverages are available to those who desire them with their meals or during after-ski relaxation." Other residents, like Marjorie Dubois of the Grahamsville Methodist Church's Social Concerns Committee, lobbied hard to keep Downsville dry. And in the end, the teetotalers took the vote, and Moshe's plans for a ski resort went straight downhill. It would be another 45 years before Downsville finally reversed its long-standing prohibition in a 2015 vote.
The property remained in the family. It was passed down to Mr. Meyer's grandson, Jonathan Leitersdorf. And he was the one who was entertaining the proposal to develop the property more recently. But yeah, I think one of the things that's really unique about the property is that it's got this ridgeline going through the heart of it, consisting of about seven peaks, anywhere in elevation from 2,400 to 2,700 acres. And all the rainwater that hits that ridge, it flows south to the Neversink River, which then flows into the Neversink Reservoir, providing drinking water downstate, but also improving water quality for the communities around here. And then all of the runoff that flows to the north flows right into the Fir Brook right here, which then flows into the Willow Umoc. So one of the huge benefits of protecting this property is from a water quality standpoint.
As I've been getting to know the property, one of the things that strikes me the most about it every time I'm here is just the water is just gushing up out of the ground here. There's so much water. There's probably 20 springs or something like that. And some of them the locals have been relying on for generations for their drinking water.
The plan at this point is to transfer the property to the state, the DEC, is that correct?
That's right, yeah. We're going to likely hold on to it for the next couple of years and work with New York State DEC to eventually convey it to the state. So, yeah, Charlie and his team, we're kind of working together to come up with a sort of an interim management plan during OSI's ownership. But once it is transferred to the state, it'll likely be incorporated into the adjacent Willow Weemock Wild Forest, which is a 14,800-acre unit of the Catskill Forest Preserve. And the Willow Weemock Wild Forest currently allows for like a whole host of different uses, like recreational uses. So runs the gamut from hiking to fishing, hunting, snowmobiling out here, backcountry camping. Yeah, so I think when the Blue Hill property is incorporated into the Willow Weemock, it's likely to see similar uses, providing a whole host of different recreational opportunities out here.
I guess if the state wanted to, they could have made the offer directly to the previous owner, right? So can you explain a little bit about how OSI works as kind of an intermediary, or what the process is when you buy land and where does it ultimately go? Is it always this kind of transaction?
Yeah, so we work a lot with the two state agencies, both the Department of Environmental Conservation and with state parks, to kind of understand their priorities. And when we get a better sense that this was maybe going to be available for sale, we were kind of in touch with DEC all along to make sure that if this was a priority, we could kind of act quicker. Sometimes it just takes longer for their acquisition process to play out. We're a private nonprofit. We can act a little bit more nimbly, and we have access to private capital and also some foundation grants and loans and things. As a private nonprofit, we are able to problem solve and just act a little quicker and ultimately secure the property so that the state process can play out and we can eventually sell it to the state.
And there's another incentive from the state side, which is this 30 by 30 initiative. Can you tell me about
that? Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. I probably should have mentioned that. I mean, this property, 3,100 acres, about 2 hours northwest of New York City, doesn't come up too often. And so, yeah, I think this an acquisition of this size definitely helps to advance the goal of New York's conserving 30% of the state's land and waters by 2030. I think it's estimated that right now New York has about 22% of its land and waters protected. So we still have quite a ways to go. There's probably about 2.8 million acres left in order to hit that goal. And I mean, and it's not just to hit like kind of an arbitrary mark. This is kind of critical in terms of helping to achieve our climate goals in the face of extreme weather. And land conservation plays an important role in helping to kind of mitigate the effects of extreme weather and climate change.
And this is a substantial purchase in terms of Catskills history. I think I read that this will be the largest acquisition in the past 25 years for the Catskill Park.
Yeah, I think we've estimated that. We think the last kind of largest parcel was the former Lundy Estate, which actually kind of straddles the Catskill Park blue line, and that is now part of both the Sundown Wild Forest and the Vernoykill State Forest. At that time, it was a 5,400 acre acquisition that both Open Space Institute and the Trust for Public Land were able to work on together. And so I think this basically constitutes the largest addition to the Catskill Forest Preserve since that acquisition back about 25 years ago. One thing I mentioned too is we do have a program at OSI called our OSI Parks Program. So over the years, the New York State government has appropriated funding in order to basically improve the infrastructure of the state park system and also trails and just enhance the visitor experience for people who want to get out and enjoy these places. And so OSI established its own sort of parks program where we help to rejuvenate trails, develop new trails. We've helped to develop new visitor centers. So yeah, it's great that we have all these places, but we want to try to make them more welcoming to folks and more welcoming to all groups. And we're very busy with that program. There's a big need for those kinds of projects, especially within our kind of traditional focus areas.
All right, big question, which you've both alluded to throughout this walk. What's the importance of protecting a place like this to be forever wild?
Yeah, I mean, a couple things come up for me when we've kind of talked about. We're right here on the bank of the Fir Brook, which is a critical tributary to the Willowemoc, which then leads into the Beaverkill, which then leads into the Delaware River. And millions of people depend on the Delaware River Basin for drinking water, for jobs. And then just south of here, like we've mentioned, it's helping the water quality for the Neversink Reservoir. And then it's helping water quality for local communities as well. So I think there's a huge kind of water quality benefit. Recreation. I mean, I'm a parent of a 15-year-old and a 12-year-old, and anytime that we can get them out, get them off the screens is a win. So providing more opportunities for people to get out. And the wild forest designation is one that does allow more uses, whereas when you get more into the interior of the Catskill Park, you're looking at those wilderness areas, which for good reason, some of the recreation options are sort of limited. You want to still maintain that kind of wilderness character. But a wild forest, which is what the Willowemoc is, just a few hundred yards from here, allows for a little bit more intensive uses like backcountry camping, like hunting, like fishing, biking, cross-country skiing in the winter, snowmobiling. So, yeah, I'm a big fan of providing more opportunities for recreation. And then, I guess, lastly, the fact that this is just a contiguous forested block. It sucks in carbon. It provides invaluable habitat for plants and animals. Those are kind of the things that kind of rise to the forefront in terms of what are the benefits of this property.
Yeah, I would just add that several years back, the Nature Conservancy did a major study on what places are the sort of resilient bastions against climate change, where the biodiversity of plants and animals will be sustained through a changing climate. And this is one of those places that stands out. A lot of topographic variation, the calcareous soils of the Catskills and the calcareous bedrock.
Calcareous soils and rocks are rich in calcium carbonate, and they play an active role in climate dynamics. Calcareous rocks absorb and store atmospheric CO2, and the soils buffer pH levels, helping to stabilize organic matter and improving the land's ability to trap carbon.
And then the fact that it's a continuous forest block means there's a lot of kind of connectivity. So in times of changing climate, these are the kinds of places that'll be refuges for plant life and wildlife.
I don't think anything's ever 100%. Are you 99% sure that this will go to New York State?
I mean, we're hopeful. We don't have any kind of like rock solid commitment, mm-hmm. but we do have really great relationships with the folks at New York State DEC, along with when we're working on projects for state parks. We really prize those relationships, and we work with really good people there. And so I think, yeah, like we've mentioned, because this would help to advance the 30 by 30 goal, since it's directly adjacent to the Catskill Forest Preserve, I think there's a really strong chance that the property will eventually go to the state, hopefully within the next 2 to 3 years.
And worst case scenario, it still stays forever wild because you're not going to sell it to a developer.
That's right, yeah.
So it's in good hands.
Yeah.
Here comes the rain.
More information at openspaceinstitute.org. For WJFF Radio Catskill, this is Brett Barry.
Thanks to Brett for that. And you can hear the full episode and all of the episodes of CatsCast, the Catskills podcast, at catscast.com. That's spelled KAATSCAST.com. It's the biweekly series featuring Catskills culture, history, sustainability, local interviews, and the arts. And Brett Barry produces those at Silver Hollow Audio in the heart of the Catskills. And they've been voted best regional podcast 3 years in a row now. And thanks to Brett for sharing those stories with us here. That's all for this edition of Radio Catskill. Reminder, you can hear our show and all of our local shows at WJFFradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Federal funding for public media has been eliminated. The funding cuts will hit October 1st, and they will likely hit small rural newsrooms like this one especially hard. This community could lose access to local news, national reporting from NPR, music and cultural programming, and crucial emergency alerts. Please help safeguard this free public service by donating today. Here's how.
Give now at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. There's an air quality alert in effect again for the region, specifically the counties in New York. That goes until 11 o'clock. Mostly sunny, high of 87 today. A few clouds tonight, a low of 64. Tomorrow, rain back in the forecast. Partial cloudiness early with scattered showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon and a high of 81.
WJFF Jeffersonville. Streaming online at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.